Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, August 9th, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. 40 years ago, on August 9th, 1974, the President of the United States, Richard M. Nixon, resigned from office with a threat of being impeached for the crimes associated with the so-called Watergate burglary and its cover-up hanging over his head. He was the first and only president to resign from office. The break-in into the Democratic National Committee offices at the Watergate Hotel had occurred more than 2 years earlier, on June 17, 1972. An investigation into the crime was dragging on through an accelerated series of hearings, the establishment of a special investigative committee on Watergate. But even as the investigation was continuing, Nixon won re-election on November 7, 1972, with the largest plurality of votes in American history up to that time. Yet less than 2 years later, he resigned in disgrace from office. Now here we are 40 years later, and we've seen what's called the imperial presidency, which Nixon was accused of building at the time, grow far beyond his wildest imagination. Under President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney, and now under Barack Obama, we've seen presidents do in the open what Nixon did secretly, including launch wars on false pretexts, violate the authority of the executive branch by overriding or ignoring the Congress, spying on the American people, and so on. And while the U.S. at the time of the Nixon presidency was engaged in a proxy war with Russia in Vietnam, today Obama is intent on provoking an actual war with Russia, with his administration's actions most immediately in Ukraine. And also, while he is taking measures such as warlike sanctions against Russia and planning to expand NATO forces eastward to the very border of Russia, the U.S. economy and that of our European allies is headed for a total crash as a result of 40 years of post-industrial, greeny, and free trade policies, which are part of the legacy of the Nixon presidency. So today on our program, we're going to take up the theme, Impeachment Then and Now. And joining me, we have a very special guest, a friend of mine, an attorney, Douglas Caddy, who was the first, Doug had a very intimate involvement with the whole Watergate case, as you'll hear from the discussion today. And also joining me will be EIR editor Tony Papert. Both of these guests, Douglas Caddy and Tony Papert, had a unique vantage point for the unfolding of these events on that August day 40 years ago. So, Doug and Tony, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, Doug, I'd like to start with you to set the stage for what happened 40 years ago by telling us, first of all, how you came to be involved in what we know today as the Watergate scandal.
Well, I became involved because I had a client named E. Howard Hunt, who was later on was indicted. And the reason I knew him and came to know him, basically, was when I was graduated from, I'll make this very briefly, but when I was graduated from law school in New York University Law School, I went to work for General Foods Corporation in New York, and after a year there in White Plains, New York, they said they were going to send me to Washington, D.C. to open up their office there and be their spokesman. But they said they wanted me to work for the first year out of their public relations firm, the Robert Mullen Company. That was their outside public relations firm. And so in 1969, I was sent down, and I, as a General Foods employee, I started working out of the Robert Mullen Company. What General Foods did not tell me was that the Mullen Company was a CIA front. In fact, it actually was incorporated by the CIA, and that General Foods was cooperating with the CIA through the Mullen Company. About 6 months after I had arrived there in Washington there, Howard Hunt joined the staff of the Mullen Company. Richard Helms had placed him there, and Howard Hunt and I started talking. It turned out that Howard Hunt, his children were, the godfather of his children was William F. Buckley. William F. Buckley was actually a CIA agent under Howard Hunt in Mexico City. And I knew Buckley through the founding of Young Americans for Freedom in 1960, a conservative youth organization. And in fact, I'd written for National Review an article when I was still at Georgetown as an undergraduate.
Now, Doug, just so our listeners get this, E. Howard Hunt has a very significant role both in Watergate but in other things. Just tell us a little bit about E. Howard Hunt, who was your client.
Well, E. Howard Hunt actually, in World War II, was in the OSS. He was stationed in the Pacific. He landed behind lines in China, and he and his squad watched a colleague being killed by the Japanese in a very terrible way. And after World War II ended, he joined the CIA. He was a charter member, you might say, of the CIA. And he was also an author, and he was very close to all the leadership of the CIA. I mean, Alan Dulles' book on statecraft. He ghost wrote that book. He was so close to the Dulles brothers. And so he has a fascinating history that goes way back into World War II.
And so you came into contact with him, pick it up again then in 1979, or 69, 1970. That was the entry point for you into the Watergate question?
Yes, in 1971 I left General Foods employee and went to work for a law firm in Washington. Howard Hunt was my first client. He had some legal issues dealing with all the books that he had published, and so I did some legal work for him in that regard. And then in April of 1972, a partner of my law firm, John Kilcullen, called me into his office and said, the Lawyers Committee for the Reelection of the President wants us to volunteer someone to work in their Nixon campaign, and you're being volunteered. Uh-huh. And please call George Webster, the chairman, and find out what your assignment is. I called George Webster. He said, please report to John Dean's office, to John Dean in the Council of the President in the White House. So starting in April of 1972, two months before Watergate broke, I was doing work for John Dean, ordinary legal campaign work for John Dean and for the reelection group. And then George Webster said, he called me and said, I have a new assignment for you. I want you to work for Gordon Liddy. Gordon Liddy was the counsel to the Finance Committee, which was separate than the Committee for the Reelection of the President. So as Watergate came to break, I was working for both John Dean and for Gordon Liddy. And in fact, my last assignment from John Dean was Friday, the day before the break-in, before the arrest, was to go to Jack Anderson's office and find out information about a column he had written about Senator Muskie. And so the way I got directly involved in Watergate, the arrest took place at 2:30 a.m. at the Watergate complex. The five burglars were arrested. Hunt and Liddy escaped. And Hunt called me at 3:05 from his office in the White House and said, could he come to my apartment, which was about a mile from the White House and a mile from Watergate, to talk about a legal matter.
Just a second. So within an hour after the break-in happened and the so-called Watergate burglars were arrested, Hunt called you.
He called me actually 35 minutes after the arrest.
Uh-huh. Okay, go
ahead.
Arrests were
at 2:30, and he called me at 3:05. He did arrive at my apartment there at 3:35. Now, I testified to all of this before the federal grand jury, and that's why the times are specific here.
Yeah.
And he stayed there for about an hour and a half, and we put a call into Gordon Liddy, and Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt retained me to represent them in the case and represent the five that had been arrested. I called a partner of the law firm, the only one that was in Washington that weekend, and he arranged for me to meet a lawyer who's... We were a labor law firm representing management and labor management issues. We were not a law firm that dealt with criminal defense matters. But he arranged for another lawyer to meet me at the courthouse the next day who was a criminal defense lawyer. And so that's how I actually got involved, starting to represent them.
And then one of the aspects of your notoriety is you were the first person sent to jail involving Watergate. Tell us how that happened.
Well, that's not quite accurate, to be honest.
Okay.
What happened was on the break-in was June 17th. On June 28th, I was in the courthouse representing the defendants in the case when I was approached by one of the assistant U.S. attorneys, Donald Campbell, who thrust a subpoena in my hand and said, "You are to appear forthwith before the grand jury." Forthwith means right then. He grabbed me by the arm and pulled me into the grand jury room. And so I started testifying at that time. Over the next month, I testified on six. I had six appearances, a total of six appearances. On June 12th, Judge Sirica in open court accused me of being a participant in the crime.
You mean July 12th?
July 12th, less than a month after the break-in, July 12th, and which was completely false, as was, I said it was false at the time, but we had to wait to prove it. And he said if I didn't testify before the grand jury, he would hold me in contempt of court. He did so the next day. I refused to appear before the grand jury because and answer these questions because of the attorney-client privilege, because I was representing these individuals. And so on July 18th, the U.S. Court of Appeals upheld Judge Sirica's decision that I be held in contempt of court. And my law firm, my lawyers, agreed I should go before the grand jury, which I did on July 19th. Now, very, very briefly, if there is an Oval Office tape of a discussion between John Ehrlichman and President Nixon on July 19th about my going before the federal grand jury. They review how I got involved and so forth, and then it's noted that I am representing the secretary to Chuck Colson, who was one of Nixon's lawyers in her divorce action, and Nixon makes a statement. Well, that's the closest it gets to the White House. We don't see a problem here with Caddy. But there was a problem right there, because what had happened was John Dean had never informed Nixon or Ehrlichman or Haldeman that I had been working out of his office for 2 months, and he never informed that over the 4th of July, which is 2 weeks after the Watergate case broke, I'd been the first person approached with the hush money, and I turned it down. Anthony Ulasewicz, retired policeman, New York City policeman, detective, was the go-between John Dean and myself. I was approached with the hush money, and I turned it down. This all came out in testimony later on. The lawyer who succeeded me in representing Hunt did take the money, and later was an unindicted co-conspirator in the case. So that...
Well, Doug, when did you realize that this was going to be a bigger issue?
Well, I realized that the night that Hunt came to, or the morning that Hunt came to me at 3:35 a.m. and heard the story, I realized what you told me, that this was actually going to end the way it was going to end if things were not done. I realized the Nixon presidency was in danger, put it that way. And the next day, John Kilcullen, who had been indicted, returned, and I met with him and his wife at their home in Virginia, and he asked, "What is this all about?" And after it finished, he said, "Boy, the Republicans have really messed it up this time. They've really done it to themselves." So anybody, don't forget that John Mitchell was on the West Coast with Martha Mitchell when he got the news of the arrest and the break-in and so forth, and they had to sedate Martha Mitchell. She became so, upset about
John Mitchell was a close friend of Nixon and his attorney general at the time.
Yeah, at his time, and ultimately they have said that he was the one who authorized, and I don't know whether it's ever been proven or not, authorized the final entry into Watergate. But the point being, anybody who picked up the paper, the Washington Post paper, that morning and saw what had happened realized this was going to be a big, big story. And I will just add one other thing. The arresting officer of the burglars was sitting a block away waiting for the arrest to take place. He had been tipped off 2 weeks ahead of time. He was supposed to go. His name was Carl Schaffer. He was actually a military intelligence officer who had been assigned to the Washington, D.C. police. He'd been working there for several years, really on fighting the weather on a man underground and people that they had targeted and so forth. He was supposed to go off duty, but he asked to stay on duty. And he was actually parked a block away when the calls for the arrest came, and he did arrest the burglars. Now, the interesting point about this is that right after the arrests were made and the burglars were sent off to jail, to the local jail to be held for court the next day, he called the Washington Post to tell them what had occurred. And the Washington Post, who did they select to give this story to but to Bob Woodward? And who was Bob Woodward? Bob Woodward was a naval intelligence officer before he went to work for the Washington Post. So we had a military intelligence officer who had prior knowledge of the break-in, actually planned, he and military intelligence planned to bring Nixon down, giving the story to the Washington Post, which passed this information along to Bob Woodard, a former military intelligence officer who was the liaison between the Pentagon and Nixon's administration. He regularly briefed General Alexander Haig in the White House. And so I've always believed that Carl Schoffer was a deep throat, that he continued after that first call to provide information to the Washington Post as to what was going on.
You're listening to Douglas Caddy, who's an attorney who was involved intimately in the Watergate affair. And Doug, what you're saying is that the official version of events still does not get at the real story.
That's exactly true. It's exactly true. At the time, one of the senators said this was the most investigated case in American legal history. Well, I was never even called by the Senate Watergate Committee. And when I did go before the grand jury on July 19th, the prosecutors cut me off. They cut me off from testifying about the fact that I was working out of the White House for John Dean, had been doing so for 2 months, and they cut me off about testifying that I'd been approached with the hush money 2 weeks before. Now, why did they do that? Well, if you read the Oval Office tapes a few days later, Ehrlichman and Nixon are discussing, oh, John Dean is over there at the Justice Department. He's working with the head of the Henry Peterson, who was head of the criminal division of the Justice Department, to limit the investigation. And so John Dean did not want any of this to come out. His girlfriend, Maureen, who became his wife, was the roommate of Heidi Reichen, who was a madam of a prostitution ring that allegedly operated was allowed to operate out of the Democratic National Committee. So John Dean had his own agenda, separate and apart from the president. And my contention boils down to, had I been allowed to testify on July 19th, which was just about a month after the Watergate break-in, as to the fact that I had answering all the questions that had been posed to me, and then being able to say that I've been working out of John Dean's office for 2 months, and I've been approached and turned down the hush money, the case would have been over. The country and the nation would have been spared. If Nixon had known this when he said there was no problem, he would have said, we do have a problem here, how do we deal with it? I think Nixon would have said, let it all come out now, we'll just let it all come out now, and let the chips fall where they may. Well, we weren't going to be able to save the five that were arrested. It was a clear-cut case of burglary, and Hunt and Liddy were obviously implicated. And so those two would have been cut off. I mean, it would have been pretty obvious that they were going to go to prison. And the case could have been wrapped up, but what happened when it proceeded for 2 years until the Nixon resignation in 1974, whose anniversary we're now observing, and through all the release of the Oval Office tapes and all the turmoil, when it all could have been wrapped up on July 19th, had John Dean properly informed Nixon, Ehrlichman, and Haldeman what was going on.
Well, now let me bring in Tony Papert to put this into the broader context of the assault that was underway, literally from the moment of the death of John F. Kennedy, to transform the United States into a puppet state of the City of London financial system, the British Empire. Tony, you've been listening to Douglas Caddy's recounting some of these events. You were, at the time, a leader of Lyndon LaRouche's movement, which was intervening both against the Vietnam War, but also against the economic changes that were being introduced, especially after August 15th, 1971. So give us your sense of how this fit in with the changes that we've seen now over the last 40 years.
What value in economy actually is. People falsely believe that there is value in money. There's not value in money. What value in economy actually is increase of the productive power of labor, and what drives increase of the productive power of labor is original human scientific and scientific technological discoveries. That's what drives value. That's what makes an economy actually work. And John Kennedy, like Franklin Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, and George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, other leaders of what's called the American system of political economy, John Kennedy was very well aware of this. I mean, the leading edge of his effort was the space program, bringing man to the moon and so on. But what's less often noted today is that he had extremely wide-ranging powers, wide-ranging plans for nuclearization of the U.S. He planned for massive use of nuclear power to desalinate seawater, to end the aridity of the western parts of the United States, west of the Mississippi. He had a program which was, like all these things I'm mentioning, he had a program which was strangled once he was killed. He had a program to introduce fusion power, beyond fission, fusion power, man's control of what powers the sun. So all these were part of the Kennedy administration, really in emulation of what Franklin Roosevelt had done in his time. Because as Harley knows well, Franklin Roosevelt's widow, Eleanor Roosevelt, was a key advisor in these most critical kinds of questions and others, which we could mention as well.
Well, Tony, who wanted to strangle that program? Whose interest was it to reverse the direction that Kennedy was taking the United States?
It's the British Empire. It's the British Empire that killed Kennedy. It's the British Empire that has killed every American president who has been murdered. And some, you know, they tried to assassinate some others like Ronald Reagan. It's the British Empire, and we've actually written on that. You can find that on our website. It's the British Empire is responsible for the murder of American presidents who go in this direction of the American system of high technology, rising technology industry, scientific discovery, and, you know, what can be summarized has been in more recent times by Lyndon LaRouche and some Russian scientists as rising energy flux density in production, which you see with the transition from, for instance, coal and oil to fission power, and then from fission power to fusion power. You're having a higher and higher energy flux density or temperature equivalent of the sources of energy production and other forces in the economy. It's the British Empire that wants to return us, and has wanted from the beginning, to return us to a depopulated, deindustrialized country without technology. And it was the British Empire that killed Kennedy.
And where does Nixon fit into this picture then, the Nixon administration?
Well, you had you had Kennedy, of course, followed by Lyndon Johnson, who in my view was not really a bad person. But he said before he died that he had seen his neck in the crosshairs of the rifle that killed Kennedy every day he was in office. So there were many of the things he wanted to do, he couldn't do. And things he may not have wanted to do. I mean, the big issue was the Vietnam War. Kennedy said, no, the United States is not going to go to war in Vietnam. That's it. That was the biggest reason he was killed immediately. He said no to the Vietnam War. His British-aligned advisors like McNamara said yes. The British Empire said yes. Kennedy was eliminated, and we went to war in Vietnam. We were at war for a decade. We lost 50,000 people. The total number of dead in that war was certainly in the millions.
Tony,
killed the U.S.
Excuse me for interrupting, but didn't LBJ, 24 hours after Kennedy's assassination, issue an order reversing Kennedy's position on Vietnam and indicate we were going to induce large numbers of troops into Vietnam?
You're the one with the photographic memory, Doug. Whether he did it 24 hours or not 24 hours, he definitely did it. He went along with it, and that's what happened.
Yeah, I mean, because Brown and Root who benefited from it were his supporters, right?
Well, that's not the reason. But the reason is because he knew that was the reason that Kennedy had been shot, and if he didn't want to be shot, he was going to do what Kennedy had refused to do and go to war in Vietnam, which is what he did, which destroyed the U.S. economy, destroyed our whole young population who went over there. They were chewed up. They went crazy. They went into drugs. We had as a result of the Vietnam War, we had the growth of, during that war, of the thing here generally called the drug sex counterculture. So we had a whole generation rendered unfit for production, unfit for life. And since then, we've had a series of degenerations from that point.
I think also it's important that the war introduced a huge amount of spending and a force from the outside to change the economy, with the whole pressure coming from Britain with the pound crisis and then the dollar crisis. And Tony, I think it's highly relevant for you to just talk about what we were doing, what Lyndon LaRouche was doing and you were doing leading up to the August 15th, 1971 definitive break with the Bretton Woods system by Richard Nixon.
Yeah, well, we were saying an end to this policy of deindustrialization and what it was called then. I mean, it was called by us deindustrialization, but what it was more generally known as was the white collar, that blue collar employment in actual physical manufacture of useful things was over. Forget about it. We're not going to do it here anymore. And what ultimately happened, of course, is we sent those industries over to China and other parts of Asia, to some extent to South America, and stopped producing things here. We're not going to do that. That's old-fashioned. We're going to just have white-collar labor in the United States, which doesn't get its hands dirty. And what we advocated from the very beginning, which was years before Nixon resigned, almost a decade before Nixon resigned, what we advocated was the flow of investment away from speculation, which now is practically all we invest in, is worthless speculation, turn it into actual physical production. So that was our fight in large part. And we were going against the trend of history, which is delivered to us to this darkest point right this minute. The Kennedy program went on to land a man on the moon in 1969. But years before the first man had landed on the moon, all the Kennedy programs were being taken down dramatically. The space program, nuclear, of course, we got then the green policy, which says avoid high technology, avoid nuclear, return the earth to the trees and animals, people to have no place here. What in those days we denounced as a white collar instead of blue collar policy, a policy of unproductive investment, has since become a speculative worldwide casino, the like of which has never been seen quite on Earth.
Well, all of this was then pushed ahead dramatically by the decision on August 15th, 1971, to sever any relationship of the dollar to gold and to end the fixed exchange rates of the Bretton Woods system.
Exactly.
Into a floating exchange system, which Nixon did largely under pressure from Arthur Burns and George Shultz.
Yes, exactly.
And then as a result of that, once you turn currencies into speculation, you create certain kinds of imbalances. The International Monetary Fund became essentially a collection agency for the global banks. And this was occurring as the war was continuing, and then as this question came up after June 72 of what was the Watergate all about. Now, one of the things I had talked with Doug before the program about this question of the imperial presidency, and I know, Tony, you remember this, all the talk among Democrats during the Nixon years was the imperial presidency. And I think looking back on that, from the vantage point of what we've seen since 9/11, it was fairly mild in comparison, and I'd like both of your takes on that. Doug, what we had talked about before the program, how do you view this compared today with back then?
Well, I think the easiest way to grasp the concept is to quote former President Jimmy Carter, who said about a year ago, the United States no longer has a functioning democracy. In 1972, we did have a functioning democracy, and that ultimately led to the resignation of Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we have an imperial presidency, and the rights of Americans and the rights of people around the world have suffered tremendously. The value of the individual is nothing anymore. The value of being a citizen of the United States has been devalued. And so a lot of people can condemn some of the activities of the Nixon administration, you know, such as compiling the list of its enemies and things like that. But in retrospect, those were small potatoes compared to what is happening today.
Absolutely.
Tony, you would concur with that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's small potatoes. I mean, what happened, in my view, back at the, you know, from Watergate to the Nixon resignation, is that the one significant thing that happened, and this speaks to some of the facts which Doug has alluded to in the Watergate case, is that eventually the American establishment realized that this guy was setting up a fascist dictatorship and he had to be stopped. But Obama, we have a much, I mean, the American establishment today is nothing. It's been weakened, or especially intellectually weakened, so much since those days. Today, we have, as you said, Obama going so much farther. I mean, you know, Nixon did that Watergate break-in, the enemies lists, I mean, which are, you know, crimes, of course.
Well, Corintel Pro, black bag jobs, you remember
yes.
All of those, because you were, for those who don't know, Tony was one of the few people, as a leader of the LaRouche student movement then, who stood up against Mark Rudd in the Weather Underground when it was created at Columbia University.
Right. Yeah. No, all that's true. And it's generally part of the FBI police state also, which Nixon was associated with long before he was president. But the other thing which he did, which itself was worthy of impeachment, even though it didn't come up in impeachment discussions I'm aware of, at least, was the secret Christmas bombing of Cambodia. So involving the United States in a war against Cambodia. But the one
without going to the Congress.
Yeah. But the one thing Nixon did not do was bring the United States to war against Russia. At least he had the sense not to do that. And that is what Obama is doing. I mean, Obama, yes, going to war without Congress, which is bad enough, but it's going to war without Congress in a process of wars, which is leading us, as you were discussing, I think, a bit before the show, which is leading us to a thermonuclear war with Russia, which could break out between now. We're recording the show on Friday. It's going to be shown on Saturday. There could be nobody to see it on Saturday. That's where the situation is. With Obama is taking us to war against Russia. He started with this undeclared war in Libya, murdered Gaddafi. As soon as that was unleashed, as Lyndon LaRouche had forecast, actually, as soon as that Libyan war was unleashed, he turned his attention to Syria. He tried, and he's still trying. Well, he brought us to war in Syria. Admittedly, there's not regular U.S. troops in Syria, but everybody recognizes that the U.S. has created an insurgency against the government in Syria, which is a war against Syria.
And which has been the basis for building what's known now as the Islamic State.
Exactly. It's what brought us to what we see now in Iraq. What Obama has done in Libya and in Syria has brought us to Iraq. Meanwhile, just what he did in Syria, which was a campaign of subversion against an established government, which is war, he's done in Ukraine. He's sent us to war against the legitimate government in Ukraine. We contrived through Victoria Nuland and so forth, who's one of these witches who surrounds Obama, we contrived to get the legitimate elected Ukrainian government overthrown by a bunch of fascist nuts. They're now waging war at the Russian border against their own people, sending shells over into Russia, all under our patronage. And I mean, listeners know a lot more that could be said about what's going on. Under Obama, we're heading to war against Russia. Nixon never did that. If Nixon had done it, we wouldn't be here to talk about it.
Doug, when Nixon finally did resign on August 9th, 1974, I assume you had seen that coming much earlier.
Yes, I had. I told my closest friends in Washington, actually early on in the case, that I thought it was inevitable he would go. I mean, once I was approached with the Hush money, I knew that it would come out eventually. There was no way you could keep. There were so many players involved in this case. There was no way you could keep that secret. And eventually, Jim McCord, one of the defendants, wrote a letter to Sirica and brought the whole thing out. So, I wasn't surprised the way it turned out.
Go ahead.
I do want to mention one other aspect. This Carl Schauffler, the officer who was military intelligence officer, who was assigned to the Washington, D.C. police, who was parked a block away and supplied all this information to the Washington Post. He never became a major figure in the investigation. He did appear before the Senate Watergate Committee that said, good morning, thank you very much, and goodbye. I read his appearance before the special prosecutor. It comprises two pages. They never asked him why he was parked a block away. Now, why did he escape the attention that he should have gotten? And this is covered, by the way, in Jim Hogan's book, Secret Agenda, published in 1984. He escaped because he had the control files on almost everybody in Washington.
Huh.
He had the files of the madam. He knew who the clients were of the prosecution ring, both the boy prosecution ring that was being operated out of the that was being allowed to operate out of the Democratic National Committee, and also the woman prostitution ring. But on top of that, he had many more other things. He had Robert Merritt, who was an FBI informant, was assigned and cooperated with the FBI, with the military intelligence, and with the Washington, D.C., in having sex with over 100 men, which were recorded on videotape, so that they could blackmail these people. So he had the goods on everybody in Washington. And when he was threatened, he felt he was being threatened in the investigation, he said, "You push me too hard, I'll bring everybody down.
No.
I'll release everything I know." And I think that is the way Washington operates today. I think there's files on everybody in Congress, on the Supreme Court, in the administration. I think there are very few free people in Washington, including Obama. I think Obama's a controlled individual, too.
Yeah. Well, and Doug, you wrote a book on this, I believe, didn't you? Or you were involved in writing a book?
Yeah, I did write a book in which Robert Merritt made these disclosures about what he knew about Watergate. It's called Watergate Exposed, and part of my story is in there also.
Let me go back to one other aspect, though, that I think is important in terms of looking back then and to the situation today. You talked about the fact that there were still what you might call Democratic or Republican institutions that functioned. One of the things that happened with Nixon, which I find quite interesting, is that as the case was unfolding, it was the Republicans who went to him and told him that his support had eroded to the point that he shouldn't stay on. Barry Goldwater, John Rhodes, who was the minority leader of the House of Representatives, and Hugh Scott, who is the, I believe, the minority leader in the Senate. The three of them went to Nixon 2 days before his resignation. You were, at the time, I believe, a Republican. It was clear to the Republicans that something had to be done. Today, to get to Tony's point of the degeneration of the political culture, the Democrats, in spite of all the evidence of Obama's constitutional violations, are up to this point remaining solidly behind him, and I'd like your thoughts on that, and then I'd also like Tony to comment.
Well, I would just say, just viewing it as pure politics and as a practical matter, I don't think the idea, to be honest, of impeachment is a viable idea right now. I don't think, with so many crises going on in the world right now, people would say we just don't have the time to take out to focus on impeachment. It may be merited, it may not be merited, but I don't think it's a viable option right now.
Well, Tony, I know you disagree with that for very specific reasons. What would you say to that, Tony?
It's the American people, 75% to 80% of the American people want to be rid of this guy. Now, you know, what Doug says, that there are files on everybody, that's one of the reasons he's there, that neither the Republicans nor the Democrats, despite the views of their base, their electorate in both parties, has yet moved to impeach him. But it has to be done while there's still time. As I was trying to say before, if Obama is in there, at a certain point, we're going to wind up in war with Russia. It's thermonuclear war. That will involve also thermonuclear war with China and with India. And it's very likely that the biological existence of the human species will not survive such a war. It's much worse than war, which would have been partly thermonuclear during Nixon's time, which in itself would be a serious threat, certainly to human civilization as a whole. But today it's much worse.
I don't disagree with the imminent threat of nuclear war. Could I ask you this? Why would the British Empire and those who run it today want such a thing to take place?
They are willing to risk it for this very good. It's a very good question. They are willing to risk it, to risk it because their system is imminently blowing out. The whole international financial aggregate of worthless pyramided junk, which exploded in a crash last in 2007-2008, is today much bigger and much more precarious and fragile than it was in 2007 and 2008. And the thing which is going on now, which will blow that out inevitably as it proceeds, is what's called the bail-in process, what we saw in Cyprus, where to preserve the structure of worthless banking institutions, in the Cyprus case it was actually the European Central Bank, to preserve the worthless European Central Bank and other international financial institutions, the depositors of Cyprus had their money stolen to do that. This is now policy in the European Union. It was actually passed by the European Parliament after a long process about 3 weeks ago. This is policy in the U.S. under Dodd-Frank, the bail-in. And the bail-in, as Lyndon LaRouche had said, it's like cutting the cable of an elevator on the 70th floor. Once the bail-in kicks in, that's what happens to this whole financial system. Now, the British, who are the owners of this worthless financial system through, you know, shills in Wall Street and in Europe and elsewhere, the British know that perfectly well. They say that this system is going down. A new system is rising up. I mean, we had mid-July, around July 15th, the meetings of the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, in Brazil. They brought to that meeting all the heads of state of all the countries of Spanish-speaking America, from Mexico down to the very tip of the very southern tip of the continent. They met with those leaders of Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. The discussion was new continental railway spanning the South American continent. The discussion was nuclear power. Related to that is the fact that the discussion was a new Panama Canal, bigger, much bigger than the existing one, going through Nicaragua. And the discussion was what we see now with the announcement by Egypt's President Sisi that they're going to dig a second Suez Canal, much bigger than the first. So the discussion there was of progress. Now, most importantly,
Tony, let me just add one other point, which is that there had been efforts made consistently to force Russia and China to become a part of the transatlantic system, to open up their banking system, to stop their investment in raw material development, space program, things of that sort, and introduce the free trade banking system, the deregulated banking system of the West. And in the last year, the Russians and the Chinese have made it clear they're not going to do that. And part of the intent is to use the threat of war to get them to capitulate and back down, which they're not going to do.
Exactly. I mean, exactly. See, so that's the point, that you have this old dead system in the transatlantic region, which is on the brink of blowing as we speak. And you have Eurasia. And what the Imperial Masters in London are saying is, okay, our system is going. But if we can even we would rather, this is the way these Imperial guys think, as people may know. They think, well, either we're going to be in control or no one. If it takes the threat of war, which even turns into war, better that than we lose our power. That's always been the way they thought. I mean, think of, these are the circles that unleashed World War I, which was the most destructive war, certainly in modern times. It was unleashed deliberately, built over years and years and years and years by the British Empire. The British young population of young men was virtually killed off. That didn't stop them.
I wanted to ask you, what do you think is in Putin's mind? I mean, how do you think Putin is, what do you think he's thinking, and how is he going to react to these imminent threats?
Well, he is now, I mean, the one thing, I would just go back to what Harley said a minute on Putin. I mean, Harley said that the British are trying to force this free trade system on Russia and China, you know, this imperial system, which they are. And they did enforce it on Russia during the 1990s.
Right. Exactly.
In the 1990s, Russia lost more people to that oligarchical looting frenzy of the 1990s. They lost more people to that than they did to World War II. The country was tremendously set back. People, the population shrunk. Everybody with any talent or with degrees left the country. It was reduced to almost nothing. And Putin has made it his, at some point during the 90s, I don't know exactly when, he made it his life's project that he was going to reverse that. Russia was going to become a real nation again. I mean, now he is preparing for war. And we're going to put together some stuff in EIR. You can look at the site, LaRouchePack.com. You'll see it, but it's not there yet. But we're going to put together some. Now Russia is in a pre-war mode. Russia is preparing for war. If you look at the, as you know, there's all this bluster and aggression, both verbally and in through bullets and so forth, thrown at them from the West. If you look at the Russian statements of the president, foreign minister, the defense people, they're all very calm and moderate. And they just say, oh, well, you know, fine. Sanctions, you're making sanctions. We don't want to retaliate in kind. Innocent people would be hurt. We may do some things. All this very calm, level-headed stuff. The meaning of that for somebody who remembers back to the beginning of World War II is that they are in a pre-war mode. They're anticipating attack. They're not going to launch a war, but they're getting ready for war in that they're, as in 41, they're getting ready for war in that they're preparing for the attack, which they know is coming. And it is coming unless we get rid of Obama. I mean, to say that his impeachment is not politically practical is to say that we're all dead men. Because everybody knows that we're moving. What is the NATO summit, September 5th in Wales, in Britain, if we get that far, what the British have said the NATO summit should do is go beyond Ukraine to the Baltic countries, another sensitive Russian border, and place thousands of NATO troops and weapons with continuous exercises on all of Russia's borders in the Baltics right by St. Petersburg. So they say, well, if this Ukraine stuff hasn't brought us to war before September 4th, we have this new thing we're going to do, which will make sure we get the war we want.
Now, let me bring up a point also on this question of impeachment that I think is really highly relevant. The people who went to Nixon in early August 1974, Goldwater and others, were looking at two things that were looming ahead. One was that the country was about to spin out of control because of the fact that there would be impeachment, possible criminal proceedings, and so on. But also they knew that the what had been in place were some shifts in terms of the strategic situation, the opening to Russia and China, but also the economic crisis. And the country couldn't afford a prolonged fight over the question of the presidency. Now, people today, the Republicans, and we've been at town meetings where Republican congressmen will launch attacks against Obama, which are right, that he violated his executive authority by changing a bill in Congress with the Obamacare, that his policies on a number of areas where he's using executive authority to protect criminal investigations, as he and Brennan were doing into the Dick Cheney torture question, intimidating a Senate Intelligence Committee staff that was trying to do a report, the drone policy, the NSA spying policy, and so on. But here's the issue. Democrats now are confronted with the fact that they're headed for a collapse, a loss of the Senate in 2014. And the Democratic Party also, there are many people in the Democratic Party who know that Obama is carrying out policies that are inflicting suffering on the base of the party, labor, seniors, minorities, and so on. Now, at the same time, Republicans, instead of playing a political game of let's use the crisis, we'll sue Obama, we'll play this along and use it to win in November 2014, that kind of political opportunism is the kind of opportunism that can get us all annihilated in a war between now and then. And so what I would say is that there was something that Henry Gonzalez did in 1991, where he collaborated with an attorney, Francis Boyle, to draft a bill of impeachment against George Herbert Walker Bush if he were prepared to go into Baghdad during the so-called Gulf War at that time. And many people say that that threat of impeachment forced Bush to pull back. Minimally, putting forward a bill of impeachment might cause a shift from this drive toward war. And once the facts of the case are laid out, I think Democrats would be forced to join in an impeachment campaign against Obama. And the main reason that's not done is the use of the so-called race card and the lying in the media, which is and from the Republicans, who are basically saying you can't do it, it won't work, so let's not try. But with what's at stake, what Tony has laid out, and what you know about the erosion, what you said about the erosion of civil liberties and so on in this country, we really have no option but to wage this fight. That's how I would answer the question of the pragmatists who say, look, things are chaotic, we shouldn't go through this. That's precisely the reason why Obama should be removed.
Well, I remember watching the hearings held by Senator Biden, who was chairman of the committee at the time, prelude to Bush's war into Iraq. Senator Biden was a Democrat, and Bush thanked him publicly for supporting, through those hearings, Bush's goal to invade Iraq. So getting rid of Obama, you get Biden, who was a war hawk in those days, and so we're back to the same situation again.
No, we can't. We shouldn't have Biden either. But the point is, we blow a hole in the war thing. I mean, by getting Obama out of there, Obama is the guy now with his finger on the button. It's not, as you implied, Doug, it's not his brain that's doing the thinking. His thinking is done for him out of London through this coven of witches that surround him. They tell him what to think. But his finger is on the button right now. If we can take the finger off the button, then we can change things. We can go on and change. He's also the one who's intimidating, as Harley implied, he's the one who's intimidating all these Democrat congressmen, senators, and other Democrats from mentioning the criminal things he's doing. If we can get him out of there, take that finger off the button, then the drive for war is not on as of this instant. And the American people, who in overwhelming majority want to be rid of this guy, heave a deep sigh of relief and see the power they have, which now, under Obama, they feel they have no power at all. They're losing jobs, they're losing health care, they're losing income, they're losing everything. They're being chopped up in foreign wars for no reason.
And Doug, I think this is really a crucial point, which goes back to what you were saying about the political culture, the difference in the 70s to today. In the 70s, more Americans actually thought they had some direct connection to the policies, that they could move the Congress. Remember, we had millions of people in the streets. We had campuses and uproars. We had a much more vigorous public debate. And I think what we've seen in the last 40 years is, with the exception of momentary eruptions, the summer of 2009 against Obamacare, or the upsurge in activity bombarding the Congress against going to war in Syria last summer, outside of a couple momentary instances, we don't see that in the country today. And that's what has to change, because what we're seeing being done by this administration is far worse than anything that was done by Richard Nixon. And I'm not saying that to defend Nixon, but to incriminate this administration. And the difference is, will the people, can the population act? Can we get some people in the Congress to stand up, even one person? And, you know, we have just a few more minutes left. You know, in reflecting back on this whole situation, you know, Doug, I'd like your thoughts on, just to reiterate what you were saying about the changes in the country in terms of the political culture from then and now.
Yeah, it's been a dramatic change, but it occurs to me while we're talking, because I'm learning a lot from the discussion here, actually, that if Henry Gonzalez made that, introduced that bill and saying that George W. Bush, if he pushed further, could be impeached, I think if you want to pursue this, that the bill should be introduced that Obama apparently is heading, taking the United States to a nuclear war, and this is the basis for impeachment.
No, I think it should be.
That would focus on both of those issues right away.
Yeah, it should be. Sure, should be. Absolutely.
And also broadly, that what he's done is to assert the power of the executive beyond its constitutional mandate. And I think that's something that most people would agree with and have seen, including the argument that we can target American citizens for assassination without due process, which happened in the case of the al-Awlaki drone killing. So there are many, many bases for an impeachment. But I think the overriding issue right now is the survival of the nation from this danger of war. And Tony, you know, your thoughts on that as we're coming to an
end. I'd like to point to the webcast, which we're being broadcast Saturday. That'll be archived Friday night. I want to go off topic and say that, because we haven't broached this directly, I wish we had, is that we talked about Kennedy and the moonshot. The Chinese have returned to the moon in behalf of, importantly, fusion energy from helium-3 on the moon. So this is a great breakthrough. What the Chinese have done on this already is a great breakthrough for mankind, and their plans go forward to actually mining helium-3 on the moon and introducing, therefore, the most advanced kind of fusion power on Earth, which we presently know is possible. So this is, again, it's completely the opposite of what we're talking about. It's really, in effect, the whole world turning to today's version of the path of progress, technology, space, and so forth, marked out by John F. Kennedy. So I would like to direct people to www.larouchepac.com to see the archived webcast, which will prominently feature that subject.
And Tony, this is critical, because, you know, what most people don't realize is there is an alternative to this depression, collapse, and war. But it does require getting into the post-Obama era. And what Doug brought up on Biden, if we had a real effort immediately to impeach Obama that had support and that was bipartisan, I don't think we'd have to worry about Biden. We'd be changing the political culture again and putting on the table LaRouche's four basic laws for real economic development and cooperation with China and Russia and the BRICS, rather than war opposition.
Right.
So I'd like to thank both of you for joining us today. Doug, it was a pleasure hearing from you.
Great meeting you, Doug, to the extent I have met you.
I appreciate being invited to participate. Thank you very much.
And, Doug, you're going to have some articles or a book coming out soon on these new revelations?
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm.
So people should look for that, Douglas Caddy, C-A-D-D-Y, And Tony, thank you very much your insights. And this is the end of the LaRouche Show for today. We'll be back next week, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for the next edition of the LaRouche Show.